Hi, and welcome to Discover CIRCRES, the podcast of the American Heart Association's journal, Circulation Research. I'm your host, Dr. Cindy St. Hilaire from the Vascular Medicine Institute at the University of Pittsburgh. And today I'm going to highlight some articles from our October 27th and November 10th issues of CIRCRES. I'm also going to have a chat with Dr. Sophie Susan and Dr. Katarina Kasari about their study, Shear Forces-Induced Platelet Clearance is a New Mechanism of Thrombocytopenia. But before the interview, here are a few article highlights. The first article is titled Single Nuclei RNA Sequencing of the Gastrocnemius Muscle in Peripheral Artery Disease, and this is by Carolyn Pass et al. Peripheral artery disease, or PAD, is caused by either atherosclerotic plaques narrowing the blood vessel lumen or by medial arterial calcifications, which prompt the inward remodeling and thrombosis. It primarily affects blood vessels in limbs, especially in the legs, and is found in around 220 million people worldwide. PAD causes pain, weakness, and muscle atrophy. While patients are prescribed cardiovascular medications, there are no treatments specifically aimed at preserving muscle function in affected limbs. To learn more about the muscle pathology of PAD, this group performed single nuclei RNA sequencing on the calf muscle biopsies from 20 PAD patients and 12 controls. The analysis of over 57,000 nuclei revealed that while the same cell types were present in both PAD and non-PAD samples, the proportion of cell types was altered. For example, there were fewer type 1, or slow twitch, myofibers, and more type 2, or fast twitch, myofibers in the PAD samples. Furthermore, transcription of genes involved in stress, atrophy, and autophagy were all ramped up in PAD samples, while genes involved in angiogenesis and muscle contraction were reduced. Evidence of denervation, increased fibrosis, and deficient signaling centered around fibroadipogenic progenitor cells was also apparent. This high-resolution comparative data reveals key cells, molecules, and pathways altered in PAD, and thus has the potential to identify novel therapeutic targets. The second article is by Duan Liu and Ming Wan et al. And is titled Myocardial Recovery in Recent Onset Dilated Cardiomyopathy, Role of CDCP1 and Cardiac Fibrosis. In dilated cardiomyopathy, or DCM, the muscle wall of the left ventricle thins and weakens, enlarging the heart chamber and reducing its ability to pump blood. The condition is commonly treated with medications aimed at reducing blood pressure and coagulation, but response to treatment is variable, and it's not clear why. While genome-wide association studies have identified DCM susceptibility genes, none of these studies have looked for loci linked to treatment responses. So in this study, these scientists measured left ventricle ejection fraction in 686 newly diagnosed DCM patients, then repeated the measurements after 6 months of standard pharmacotherapy. Most patients improved, but others did not, and some even deteriorated. GWAS analysis comparing these phenotypes strongly but not significantly suggested that a particular nucleotide variant near the gene encoding transmembrane protein CDCP1 was associated with both improved recovery and reduced CDCP1 expression. Functional studies revealed that CDCP1 promotes proliferation of human cardiac fibroblasts and thus is likely profibrotic. If the CDCP1 association can be verified, it would therefore suggest suppression of protein as a possible strategy for reducing fibrosis and improving recovery in DCM. The third article I want to share is titled NRG1 Regulates Cardiomyocyte Migration and Cell Cycle in Ventricular Development, and it's by Gregor Bessa et al. During heart development, the ventricle walls undergo a period of remodeling where muscle protrusions extend into the chamber lumen. This formation of trabeculae is necessary for proper development of the conduction system and is followed by thickening, fusion, and compaction of the trabeculae to form the robust ventricle wall. But occasionally, this process goes awry, as what happens in the case of left ventricular non-compaction, or LVNC. LVNC is a heart defect in which the trabeculae persist. To understand the normal trabeculation process and how it goes wrong, this group examined heart development in mice where neuroregulin 1, or NRG1, a gene necessary for trabeculation, was switched off or was overexpressed. Lack of the NRG1 glycoprotein prior to trabeculation led to insufficient trabeculae and embryonic death, while NRG1 overexpression resulted in excessive trabeculation and incomplete compaction. Eliminating NRGF after trabeculation did not affect compaction, suggesting the protein's role is critical, but only for a brief point of time. Further analysis revealed NRG1 regulates proliferation, cell polarity, cell migration, and spindle orientation of cardiomyocytes. Together, the data provide a detailed account of NRG1's role in the ventricular development that will help to inform future studies into congenital malformations. The last article is by Agarwal et al. And is titled, Myeloid cell-derived IL-1 beta contributes to pulmonary hypertension in HFpEF. Left heart failure, also known as heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, or HFpEF, is characterized by thickening of the wall of the left ventricle, preventing its normal filling. This can lead to increased blood pressure in the lungs as oxygenated blood becomes backed up, which may in turn increase the risk of pulmonary embolism and further heart damage. There is a well-established mouse model of HFpEF, but whether the animals also develop pulmonary hypertension is unknown. This group now confirms that indeed this mouse model does develop pulmonary hypertension, and they identify a key cell type and cytokine involved. RNA analysis of the animal's lung tissue revealed genes involved in inflammation and immunity were ramped up, and they found specifically that CD68 expressing macrophages and interleukin IL-1 beta, a cytokine produced by activated macrophages, were specifically increased. The team went on to show that reducing macrophage numbers with the drug clodronate or by diminishing IL-1 beta levels with targeted antibodies improved the pulmonary vasculature of the heart failure model. Given that HFpEF patients also have raised levels of both CD68 positive macrophages and IL-1 beta, the authors suggest such treatment strategies may have clinical utility as well. So today with me, I have Dr. Sophie Susan, who is a professor of hematology at University of Lille, and Katerin Kasari, who's a researcher at INSERM and at the Paris-Saclay University. And they are the co-corresponding authors of the paper, Shear Forces-Induced Platelet Clearance is a New Mechanism of Thrombocytopenia. So thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you.
Dr. Susan, you're a hematologist. And Dr. Kasari, you are a researcher in the field, but could you both just share a little bit about your background and how you came into this field of work and started collaborating on this study?
Okay, so I will go first. So I'm a hematologist by training, as you mentioned, and it has been a long time since I'm very interested in bleeding disorders, acquired and inherited bleeding disorders, and especially von Willebrand's disease. And almost 20 years ago, I had a huge interest in a study describing how shear force can induce acquired von Willebrand's disease. And since then, I focused my research on all these situations and trying to decipher what is the true mechanism of bleeding in these high shear force conditions, such as aortic stenosis and patients with mechanical circulatory support. So that's why I came to ECMO patients.
And so I'm Caterina Kasari, and I'm a molecular biologist by training. I trained in Italy until my PhD and then moved to France to continue to study von Willebrand disease. And basically, I've studied von Willebrand disease all my entire career, and I'm still doing that right now. And what I've done is that I've acquired a lot of expertise in mouse models of this disease, and also did a postdoc in UNC in Chapel Hill about more of the platelet signaling involved and associated with von Willebrand disease. And this is how our expertise fits and combined together in this study, actually.
Wonderful. It's a great study. I learned a lot reading it. So thrombocytopenia, for anyone who's not familiar, it's a condition that occurs when the platelet count in your blood is too low. And this study is looking at a therapy-induced mechanism that we'll talk about ECMO in a minute. But I was wondering if, before we start, we could just learn about what are some diseases or circumstances where an individual would develop thrombocytopenia?
Oh, there's a lot of conditions. So that's the issue. When you're facing a thrombocytopenia, you must understand the true mechanism. And it can be a central production that is impaired, or a destruction or consumption of platelets. And it's always very important to identify the mechanism to treat accordingly. So it's very important.
And what are some of the common reasons that platelets drop?
There are many reasons again, and some of the examples that come to my mind very quickly can be like, for example, in von Willebrand disease type 2B, it's the association of altered VWF to GP1B alpha on the platelet surface that drags platelets from circulation. Or for example, there are the other examples that are mostly associated to the development of antibodies that track platelet consumption and clearance. So yeah, there are different mechanisms, as Sophie's mentioned. Knowing the mechanisms is important to know how to treat the patient that presents thrombocytopenia.
And if I can add, in particular, in critically ill patients, there are many, many reasons that may lead to thrombocytopenia, such as disseminated intravascular coagulation, also the treatments such as heparin treatment and so on. So it's sometimes very difficult to identify the true mechanism of thrombocytopenia. But it's very important to treat them.
And the more critical the patient, the quicker you need to realize what the cause is, which is complicating.
And you must avoid to take the wrong decision for the treatment.
So in your introduction, you mentioned that thrombocytopenia is often seen in patients receiving extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, also known as ECMO, which after COVID, we are all more familiar with the term ECMO. But before we talk about your study and the connection between the platelet drop and the ECMO, could you just give a brief explanation of what ECMO is? What is it doing?
Okay, it's a lung, artificial lung, or artificial heart, or a combination of both. So it's a life-saving therapy for young patients, but still there is a very high number of complications with the hemostasis impairment, such as thrombosis and also bleeding. So it's a life-saving therapy. You save life, but there are a lot of complications, such as bleeding complications.
So before your study, what was known about that relationship between the thrombocytopenia and ECMO?
There was a piece of evidence that thrombocytopenia was common during ECMO. So it was supposed to be well known, but the mechanism was not fully identified yet, and the true frequency was not really known. And there was a systematic review of the literature showing that the frequency was very heterogeneous among different studies. And that's why we thought it could be very important to have a systematic approach on kinetic of evaluation of platelet count in patients.
Yeah, if I can summarize, basically what was the most impairment was the heterogeneity among the studies.
So people receiving ECMO are obviously very, very ill individuals, and you're enrolling patients in your study. But like you said, you know, some can be on ECMO because of lung or because of heart or because of both issues. And I think you had about 107 people in your study. What were their different reasons for ECMO? How heterogeneous or homogeneous was your patient population that you started with?
Well, when the ECMO is a heart replacement, it's called VA ECMO. And the huge majority of our patients were VE ECMO. And we have also VV, the venous ECMO. It's a lung replacement in our study. But in our study, the impact of ECMO, either VE or VV, was more important than the differentiation of VE or VV. So in our study, we looked at the different patients, but we found no differences regarding the evolution of the platelet count.
Interesting. So it's something about the therapy itself, as opposed to the underlying condition.
Of therapy, yes.
So when you started this, what was your hypothesis? Because you went through a lot of things that it's not this, it's not that. So what were you originally hypothesizing as the cause for the platelet drop?
As Katerina mentioned, we are kind of von Willebrand disease women. And so we are wondering whether the acquired von Willebrand disease that is observed, the defect of von Willebrand factor in those patients, was associated with an increased interaction with platelets. And so our hypothesis was that in patients with ECMO, maybe the drop of platelet count and the decrease in von Willebrand factor was due to this increased interaction, just like in 2B von Willebrand disease patients. So it was our first hypothesis. And we looked at the interaction between those two key players of hemostasis.
And then, I guess to cut to the chase, what did you eventually find as the mechanism triggering this platelet loss?
I would say that indeed our first hypothesis was wrong, because very briefly, there was no association between VWF degradation or multimerization and activation and the thrombocytopenia in the ECMO settings. And what we have demonstrated is that really the change in the blood flow and in the shear that is inherent to the ECMO is the driving force that caused the sheddings of GP1B-alpha and indeed the platelet clearance of these platelets that don't express anymore the GP1B at their surface.
And can you just explain that mechanism a little bit? So what is this GP1B protein and what happens to the platelet? Where does it go?
So very briefly, so GP1B-alpha is one of the major receptors for von Willebrand factor that is present on platelet surface. And their interaction is a key interaction for hemostasis process. It's the binding between VWF and GP1B-alpha that starts. It's a key for the primary hemostasis and induced platelet addition. And basically what we found that in a mechanism that is non-related to the VWF binding to GP1B-alpha, there can be cleavage of a small portion of the receptor. And in this case, there are signalings and modifications, let's say, secondary to this event that we don't understand or we don't know yet completely. But what we have seen is that there is an increased platelet clearance of these specific platelets that don't have any more this portion of the receptor at their surface. About where they go, we don't know exactly. We know that disappear from circulation. We don't know exactly if they are trapped in a specific organs or if they are immediately cleared. There are other studies that have looked into platelet clearance associated to GP1B-alpha shedding, but the mechanisms are different to what is happening in this setting. So there is still a lot of work to do.
It's really interesting. And I thought one of the things that really kind of piqued my interest was when you were looking at this in the patients, this drop, this platelet drop started after only 1 hour of ECMO. Were you surprised by that finding?
Well, yes, in a way we were surprised that it was in more than 90% of patients 1 hour after, whatever the reason for ECMO implantation was. And also what was surprising is the very rapid correction of the platelet count after removal of ECMO. So it was really linked to the therapy of ECMO. So to summarize what Katarina said, so the platelets feel the force with this GP1B alpha portion that is cleaved given an amount of shear. And so it was, for us, it was very interesting to identify that only shear conditions were involved in the mechanism of thrombocytopenia, whatever the other conditions are in the patients.
That's so interesting. So I guess the other component of shear is the endothelial cell. And as you are VWF people, I'm sure that was in your mind as well. Do you know what's happening to the endothelium of these patients? Is part of what this process is any kind of signal perhaps from the endothelium? Do we know?
We don't know yet, but we have, let's say, some evidence that something is happening to the endothelial cells. And the best example is the rise in VWF. Those patients have for sure endothelial cells aggression, given their underlying disorder and given the high shear condition. So they have sometimes 300 to 400% units per ml of VWF in circulation.
So when we're talking about the flow between the normal heart and the machine, how different is it? What's similar, what's different?
So in normal condition, the flow is pulsatile. So you can feel its intermittent volume goes to the circulation. Until today, there are no cardiac assist devices that can provide such flow, and all the pumps are providing continuous flow and some turbulences within the machine, within the device. So it's rather different flow. that induced, and it was a kind of internal control for our experiments, that always induced a degradation of EWF.
That's so interesting. So, you know, in part of the study, obviously a lot of it was human-based, but you did develop a murine model and also an ex vivo system to try to model what's going on. Can you share what you did, how you developed these?
There's no one unique model that can recapitulate what's happening in patients. So we had to imagine different strategies to have an experimental approach for each part of the interaction between GP1B alpha, GP6, von Willebrand factor, and eye shear. So at first, we used a MOX circulatory loop, which is using an ECMO pump and a tubing. Of course, it's not a real ECMO because there is no endothelial cells, but it allows to investigate interaction, for instance, with the anticoagulant, with antiplatelet therapy, with the impact of the amount of shear and so on. But then we had to go to an in vivo model to look at the evolution of the platelet clearance. And that was the input of Katerina.
Yeah, so I think I can only add to what Sophie said, that indeed, it's very rare that there is one model perfect to recapitulate one clinical situation. So in this example, we basically mimic most of the shear parts in vitro or ex vivo, let's say like this, in this microfluidic or in the MOX circulatory loop. And then for the clearance part, of course, we needed the mouse model because it's very difficult to think about a perfect clearance in vitro assay, let's say like this.
Yeah, we don't have the spleen, we don't have the liver.
Yeah.
So what did your study tell us about what we need to change about ECMO or about patient therapy when they're receiving it?
I don't know if it's changed something right now, I mean, on a therapeutical point of view, but for the investigation facing a thrombocytopenia in patients with ECMO, you must know that each patient will undergo a drop in platelet count. And before switching, for instance, for heparin to other anticoagulants, it's important to have that in mind and to perfectly know that this eye shear condition is part of the mechanism. For sure, it is, maybe it's not the only mechanism, but it's responsible for at least part of the drop in platelet count. So I think it's very important. And we are waiting for how the paper is coming to the medical community. But it's quite interesting to look at what will be in recommendations and so on, the impact of our finding.
It's also maybe related to what we mentioned at the very beginning, because there are many situations that are associated with thrombocytopenia, and sometimes the pathological or the molecular mechanism is not already elucidated. And this is a new mechanism that has been elucidated and could perhaps be the same for other situations.
Yeah, and I was thinking about mechanism. What do we know about the cleavage of the GP1B alpha and that mechanism of action as it relates to what you found, which is shear force activates it? What do we know? Or what can you share about that? Because I'm sure that's what you're going after.
Yeah. Maybe Katerina, we still have some questions, but...
Yes, I can start on that. I would start saying that the field of GP1B alpha shedding is large. There are many studies and many more unknowns. So what is known already is that it can happen in heterogeneous situations. And what is known is also that it can happen in many ways. Let's say that historically, it is associated with platelet activation, and it has been shown that it was mediated by metalloproteases once it's ADAM 17. But there are other studies, for example, in von Willebrand disease type 2B, which have demonstrated that the shedding is not associated with platelet activation, and again, not dependent on this metalloprotease. So I think that to summarize, what is known is there and it's true, but probably there are many more mechanisms that can provide the same outcome.
And for sure, it's an important point because it gives an idea of what kind of treatment we can apply if we try to inhibit this shedding. So the first answer that we provide in the paper is that in vitro, adding EDTA, inhibiting metalloproteases, is inhibiting the shedding. but it's the first piece of evidence.
Yeah, well, because there are many metalloproteases that can have similar effects. So deciding exactly which one it is, it's a little bit more complicated, and we still need some work to answer that question.
Absolutely. To me, that's the sign of a great study, right? Is it almost creates more questions than it initially sought out to answer. So thank you both for taking time to chat with me today. This was a very interesting study. I commend you on all the work, wrangling up the patients and also the mechanistic studies. So Dr. Sophie Susan and Dr. Katerina Kasari, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having us on board today. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the highlights from the October 27th and November 10th issues of Circulation Research. Thank you so much for listening. Please check out the CircRes Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram with the handle @CircRes and hashtag DiscoverCircRes. Thank you to our guests, Drs. Sophie Susan and Katerina Kasari. This podcast is produced by Ashara Ratnayaka, edited by Melissa Stoner, and supported by the editorial team of Circulation Research. Some of the copy text for the highlighted articles was provided by Ruth Williams. I'm your host, Dr. Cindy St. Hilaire, and this is Discover CircRes, your on-the-go source for the most exciting discoveries in basic cardiovascular research. This program is copyright of the American Heart Association 2023. The opinions expressed by the speakers in this podcast are their own and not necessarily those of the editors or of the American Heart Association. For more information, please visit ahajournals.org.